Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anise Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Chagpar welcomes Dr. Elizabeth Kloss. Dr. Kloss is professor of public health and biostatistics and is director of medical research at the Yale School of Public Health. Here's Anise Chagpar.
So why don't we start off a little bit by telling us about what you do and what you study?
So I lead a bit of a dual life. I'm a professor at the Yale School of Public Health. And so I do teaching and general epidemiology work there, and that's a part of how some of our recent work has come to be published. We developed the largest study of meningioma, and that's throughout the world. The last one was about 10 years ago, and we ended up looking at about 3,500 individuals, half of whom had the brain tumor that we study, which is called meningioma, and half of whom did not. And essentially, we're looking to define both genetic and environmental risk factors that might be associated with development of this tumor.
Now, meningioma, that seems like a pretty rare cancer. Can you tell us a little bit more about what exactly it is and how you got interested in studying it?
Absolutely. So meningioma actually now is the number one primary brain tumor that's diagnosed in the United States. And we think, based on some recent data from overseas, that approximately 1% of all adults actually have a meningioma. Now, the interesting thing is many of these are incidental and will never cause anyone a problem during your life, but a proportion of them will actually be quite serious. So meningioma essentially is a tumor of the lining of the brain or the spinal cord. And what makes it serious or not serious is essentially where in the system it is and how big it grows to be. So many of the lesions that I see, and usually every Friday I have a clinic where I see two or three people that have this diagnosis, probably about half of them are incidentally located. So, for example, you might have a head injury in a car accident, get an image, find incidentally a small meningioma, and usually we don't have to do anything about that. But then we have a whole other set of individuals who are symptomatic or have some change in how they function that's associated with the meningioma. So, for example, I recently had an individual who was driving his car along the highway and had a seizure. We identified the meningioma and in that case had to perform surgery on it to take it out. So there's really quite a wide variation in the size and symptoms and what needs to be done for these lesions.
Hmm. So 1% of all people have a meningioma. That's pretty scary because I can imagine that there are people sitting on their couch listening to us here on NPR on Sunday evening thinking, I've got 100 friends. One of us is going to have a meningioma. That's pretty scary. So what are the risk factors that would predispose someone to have a meningioma?
So there's a number of risk factors that we think are fairly well confirmed. The one thing that's interesting, although we've never been able to completely tease out exactly the mechanism, is there's a concept that hormones are related to risk. And so the reason that we think this is that women are almost three times as likely to be diagnosed as men with meningioma. In addition, we know that these tumors frequently can have hormone receptors, just as people may for breast cancer have estrogen and progesterone receptors. A large number of meningiomas also have this sort of hormone receptor, although more likely progesterone versus estrogen. We've looked, and actually we just did a little study where we looked to see are hormonal or reproductive factors or taking oral contraceptives or hormone replacement therapy to see whether this had an effect on risk. And we found some evidence among younger women that being current users of oral contraceptives was associated with risk. But really there's probably the other big risk factor is ionizing radiation. And that is a very long-standing, very consistent, and I think very well-known risk factor. And the way that basically people first started to understand a little bit about this risk was following up children that received radiation as a young child for another cancer. And so these individuals have been followed over time and found to have a greatly increased risk of a number of cancers, but particularly those of the brain or the spinal cord, with meningioma looking to be the highest.
So these kids who had another tumor would get radiation and they would be at higher risk. How do we know that that was the radiation and not the fact that they already had another cancer?
So you don't know 100% because obviously their genetic makeup could be a risk factor for not only the first but later cancers. However, they have looked at a very large cohort of these children and tried as much as they can to control for radiation, and not only radiation, but the other medications, chemotherapy, the age of exposure, and some genetic factors. It's fairly preliminary so far. But it does appear that it's a fairly strong relationship between the timing and the dosing of the radiation and the outcomes that these children have. And it's usually 20 or 30 years later.
And is it in the same location as the radiation? Like, I mean, if I had radiation as a kid in my big toe, would I get a brain tumor, or do I have to have my radiation closer to?
It seems very much related to the location of the original treatment, be it head or chest, face or neck. And there's additional studies beyond these childhood cancer survivors, but there's also data from the Tenaeus Capita study. So that actually is a very well-done study where it looked at children who were immigrants to Israel in the 1940s and 50s, and they received as treatment for ringworm radiation therapy to the head. And what the Tenaeus Capitis study did was they actually estimated the amount of radiation to the scalp, to the brain, to the face, to the head. And although the estimated dose to the brain was probably in the range of what a chest X-ray would be, the children were young, and they follow these individuals now for 30, 40 years, and they have noted a 5 to 10-fold increase in risk of meningioma. In addition, risk of glioma, which is a malignant brain tumor, and acoustic neuroma. So it's a nice study in the sense that there were very stringent measurements made and very good follow-up. In addition, not only were the children looked at, but their family members who may or may not have also received radiation. So they have really a very controlled cohort to compare these children to.
What about radiation from other sources? I mean, has anybody looked at patients who may have been exposed, say, to Chernobyl or massive radiation toxicities from nuclear power plants and so on?
They do have data on that. It's primarily at this point from the bombings in Japan. Part of the relationship between radiation exposure and meningioma development is that there's a long lag time. So the average time from exposure to development is about 20, 30, even longer in terms of years. There are cohorts set up to look at more recent exposure, such as Chernobyl, but the time span is really not long enough for us to know fully, in terms of meningioma and other brain tumors, what the outcomes will be.
And I guess the other thing that you had mentioned that I found was interesting was the exposure that people get with X-rays. So if you're a child and you're getting a chest X-ray, I mean, should we be telling kids not to get chest X-rays or dental X-rays? How do X-rays play into this whole story?
So part of our interest in looking at specifically dental X-rays, and I will say that our study included only adults, so we don't have from our particular study any data on children. But outside of high-dose therapeutic radiation, that is radiation where one's being treated for a benign or malignant tumor, at least within the United States, the most common form of exposure to ionizing radiation is dental X-rays. So that was our interest in looking at that particular X-ray imaging. Now, that may change over time because CTs are coming up and being more and more commonly used. So what we did was we looked at just a general frequency in the individuals that had meningioma and compared it to people that did not have meningioma. So we weren't able to measure specifically, you know, what are the number of X-rays that you've had since you were 2 years old. But we did ask people, and you can kind of think about whether this seems reasonable or not, but are you someone that never goes to the dentist and hence never gets X-rays? Are you someone that is a pretty regular visitor to your dentist and every 6 months you get X-rays? Are you someone who goes once a year, or are you someone that's kind of in between the never and the once a year? So we basically asked people to classify themselves as a child, sort of as a young adult, and then within the past 10 or 20 years into one of these groups. And then we just compared what did the cases say, what did the controls say. And we did find that the cases were more likely to report being a frequent user of dental X-rays than the controls. And it was fairly consistent across the age groups and the types. We did find also increased risk when people had a panoramic, which is a little more extensive dental X-ray. You tend to rest your chin, and then the X-ray machine revolves around your face. We found that individuals that had a high rate of that sort of dental X-ray were at increased risk. But I will have to say that the number of people that we had that reported that sort of exposure was pretty small, so it's a fairly limited group.
So, you know, we've talked on this show about screening tests for a variety of malignancies and certainly have talked about mammography for breast cancer, now talking more about CT scans for lung cancer. And granted, these aren't particularly close to the brain, but are reasonably close to the spine. Please tell me that there isn't an association between mammography and CT scans for screening for lung cancer and meningioma.
So at present, we have no data on that at all. But it's interesting in that there has, for a very long number of years, been a presumed or at least postulated association between breast cancer and meningioma. And it's unclear whether the risk factors are common, that many of the hormonal risk factors might be associated with breast cancer and might also be associated with meningioma. There is a supposition that perhaps some of the treatments for breast cancer, including radiation to the breast or the chest, could potentially be one mechanism for meningioma causation. But we don't know that. We really have no data on that at all. In the study that we ran, it was adult patients. So the average age of the individuals was about 57, 58. Although we asked people about their exposure and prior head CTs, because of the age of these patients, they really would not have had an extensive history of head CTs because they were sort of born before the time that these things were used very frequently.
Well, we are going to pick up that discussion and learn more about radiation and cancer right after we take a short break for a medical minute.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer, and in Connecticut alone, there'll be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting even after decades of use can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. We are discussing radiation and cancer, and specifically talking about one of the most frequent types of brain cancers called meningioma and the association that this has with various types of x-rays. So, Elizabeth, right before the break, we were talking about dental x-rays. We were talking about other kinds of x-rays. Tell us a little bit more about that association and the time lag that is required between getting an x-ray and developing a meningioma and the dose relationship of that. So if we go to the dentist and, you know, they never do an x-ray, but just this one time they say, geez, you know, I really need an x-ray. Do we say, no, I might get a meningioma or how does that work?
So we do want to make clear that obviously good dental care is important. And this is not an effort to stop people from going to the dentist. Obviously, you need to go to the dentist. You need to take care of your teeth. But as with any ionizing radiation source, you need to think about why am I having this x-ray? And that's medical, dental, whatever the trip is for. And let's have a conversation about the purpose of it. And feel comfortable with your conversation with your physician or your dentist about why it's being had. And that was one of the interesting things that we noted when we looked at the dental x-ray history and meningioma risk is we simply asked people over the past few years, how frequently do you receive a dental x-ray? And the majority of people were receiving some sort of dental x-ray every 6 months or every 12 months. So what we did was we then looked at the Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the American Dental Association guidelines, which if you go to their website, they have a very nice setup listing what the guidelines are and going through all the details of how they came to these guidelines, which are certainly very reasonable. And on that, we noted that the guidelines for an adult who was not at increased risk of having dental problem, the suggested frequency was every 2 to 3 years. So I think that was interesting that what people were reporting on average was a bit more than what we saw the guidelines to suggest. Now, obviously, the decision has to be made between each dentist and their patient. But I think it would be of interest to individuals to take a look at the guidelines. And just next time you go to dentist, doctor, you know, maybe think about what sort of screening schedule is right for you.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing, too, that we were talking a little bit about was other forms of radiation outside of the dentist's office. And mm-hmm. So, you know, certainly getting radiation therapy, if you have a cancer, for example, a breast cancer, you know, one would think that you would still recommend carrying on with your radiation therapy after your breast cancer rather than worrying about the effect that this could cause in terms of potentially increasing your risk of meningioma.
Absolutely. This is not to change anyone's treatment plan for any sort of malignancy that they may be undergoing. This is more in line of if you are receiving something that is a screening form of ionizing radiation to just as things can add up over the years, particularly now with the increase in use of CT, be it for the head or another body part. Just thinking over time, these things can add up. There's actually a very nice paper in the New England Journal about 2 or 3 years ago from a group here at Yale looking at cumulative exposure to low-dose ionizing radiation and really showing that as the years increase, the number of people that have somewhat significant amounts of exposure to ionizing radiation through PET scans or CTs or whatever they might be using is increasing quite a bit. So just to think about what is the goal of the imaging.
Right, right. One other question that comes to mind, you know, just a few weeks ago, or perhaps a little longer, we were talking to some of our colleagues in endocrine surgery and endocrine cancers, and they were talking about radioactive iodine and how this was kind of like a silver bullet in the sense that the thyroid is one of the few organs that actually can harbor iodine and incorporate this into thyroid hormone. And when you attach a radiation dose to that iodine, that we can really target thyroid cancers. Has that been looked at as a potential risk factor for meningioma?
So we did ask individuals in our study about that, and we found that, as noted here, that people that had previous therapeutic radiation, including for treatment of the thyroid, were at increased risk. But we had so few individuals that had had previous treatment for thyroid. To say something specifically about that, at least in our study, we wouldn't be able to.
And then it gets back to a similar kind of conversation that we were having with regards to childhood malignancies and whether there is something perhaps genetic that links multiple cancers together. So tell us a little bit about some of the genetic causes of meningioma, or have people looked at that?
So we're just starting to. There's one well-known syndrome, neurofibromatosis 2, or NF2. And so that is a change on chromosome 22 that is associated with not only meningioma development, but development of other tumors as well. Outside of that, though, very little is known about the genetics of meningioma. We are undertaking a germline, meaning looking at DNA from blood or saliva, now in about 1,600 individuals with and without meningioma. And we have the data up and running right now. We're just about to start to analyze that. And then two groups recently, one from Brigham and Women's Hospital and one from Yale University, looked at the genetics of the actual tumors themselves and did find some very interesting outcomes. They found a number of genes associated with development of meningioma. And what was very exciting is the two groups had some overlap of findings, which is sometimes rare in the world of cancer genetics. So we're hoping to go forward and look at some of those things. Also to look at the genetics of individuals who develop these radiation-associated meningiomas. We think that that's likely a special group because all of these, we think it's not only exposure, but the way that your genes are set up. And when the exposure meets your genotype, that some people are more or less likely to develop these tumors.
And so as we start to put this story together, we've got these genetic factors that play in, the ionizing radiation that plays in. Talk a little bit more about the hormonal factors that, that play in. You know, so hormone replacement therapy, has that been shown to be as significant or more significant than oral contraceptive use that you were talking about earlier?
So it's always been very intriguing, this potential association between hormones and meningioma. And as I mentioned, just the fact that this is a diagnosis that occurs three times more frequently in women versus men. And when you look at the increase, it's most marked before menopause. And although women are always at increased risk relative to men, the difference in risk really drops down as women pass through the menopause. As I said, there's also hormone receptors on the tumors. We looked and did find a slight increase in risk in young women currently using oral contraceptives. But what's hard to study now is the fact that most meningiomas occur in older women, so they won't be using oral contraceptives. And now most women are not using hormone replacement therapy. So the exposure in the groups have kind of separated, and I think it's a little hard to look at this. I do have a number of patients that ask me about fertility medication, and does that increase their risk? We looked at it. We had a very small number of people. We did not find an increase in risk. But I would say that the number of women we had that had used fertility medications was pretty small. We did actually, interestingly, find that the heavier you were, and presumably then the higher the circulating estrogen, the greater your risk of meningioma. We found a decreased risk associated with ever breastfeeding. and a decreased risk associated with smoking. Not to send everybody out to buy a cigarette.
Yeah. Don't smoke!
Don't smoke. But there is a well-known relationship that individuals or women who smoke tend to have lower circulating estrogen. So this sort of reverse association between cigarette smoking and outcome, it's been seen in uterine cancer and other sort of hormonally related cancers.
So now, if we have these genetic factors that we now know about or are learning about, and we know about the association with ionizing radiation and the association with estrogen, can we screen people who are at high risk for meningioma for meningioma? And are there preventative strategies for preventing meningioma?
So at this point, in terms of risk-benefit, there's no suggestion that really screening would be something that would have a high enough benefit, at least in the general population, to undertake. One thing that patients do ask me, because we have seen even among families who we don't believe to have NF2, we do see an increased risk to family members. So in our data set, we saw about a fourfold increased risk to family members of people that had been diagnosed with meningioma. Now, there's always some bias in that, in the sense that if a family member is diagnosed with some sort of tumor, you tend to look more closely in other family members. In addition, many meningiomas, although individuals may have a diagnosis of this tumor, they're clinically silent and you might not need to ever have any intervention. So there's no plan for any screening at this point in time. And it's not clear if they're not clinically significant whether you, for many of them, need to do anything anyway.
So even things like if you had a family who was an NF2 family and you had in that NF2 family a child who went to the dentist every 6 months and got dental x-rays, and then as a young female was using oral contraceptives, I who presumably would be at high risk, you would simply tell them, you know what, you're at high risk. But there really isn't preventative strategies as there are, for example, in breast cancer, where we may say, you know what, we can reduce your risk by giving you an estrogen blocker or whatever.
Exactly. So the NF2 patients are a whole other category, and they actually are screened and followed separately. And there are specific guidelines for those individuals for a variety of organ systems. But presuming that someone is not an NF2 patient, there are no set guidelines for screening or prevention, you know, other than sort of the general guidelines of try to keep your weight down and try to stay healthy.
Okay. And don't smoke, even though there is a reverse association. Don't smoke.
Correct.
So then if people are at risk, but we're not necessarily doing kind of screening tests, which would make sense because we want to reduce ionizing radiation, how do patients present? I mean, I remember the story that you told of the guy driving down the highway and having a seizure. Hopefully, there are other ways that meningiomas present if they occur in 1% of the population.
So the majority, and actually the 1% was a study in Europe where they looked at about 3,000 healthy adults, and they got an MR of the brain and then looked to see what they found. And in those individuals, about 1% had meningiomas, but they were all asymptomatic, and likely the majority would never have had an issue that would have come to clinical attention. We see all sorts of presentations, so it depends a little bit on where you are in the brain, frontal lobe, personality change, motor strip, weakness, and some are incidental. But in most instances, we can follow individuals, and if not, we can take care of them with surgery and radiation.
Dr. Elizabeth Kloss is Professor of Public Health and Biostatistics and is Director of Medical Research at the Yale School of Public Health. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.